You're listening to the home of cool, irreverent, and entertaining talk right here on LA Talk Radio. You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza. Only on LA Talk Radio.
Welcome, I'm Alan Cardoza, and you're listening to Answers for the Family. As a licensed private investigator and certified instructor in nonviolent crisis intervention, I've been fortunate to meet and work with some incredibly talented and caring people each week here on Mondays at 11 a.m., where we're able to bring you people that can help you with your family life, that are helping our kids. And I got to tell you, I'm really happy this morning to be able to bring with us one such person in Eason Ransom. Eason is currently the director of the Center for Academic Reentry and Empowerment, which is the CARE program. Now, before you tell us about the program, are you comfortable with sharing us a little bit about your journey that brought you to this point?
Absolutely.
All right.
Absolutely. A little bit about myself. I'm a retired NFL player. I played for the 49ers. Most of my career, I played 6 years with the Niners, a couple years with the Denver Broncos, a couple years with the Buffalo Bills. And while playing pro football, during that fame and fortune years, I hung around some people and made some bad choices. Subsequently, those bad choices that I made, I acquired a very expensive drug addiction. By the time I retired from football in 1987, I was addicted to crack cocaine, and that addiction cost me in the neighborhood of $1,000 a day.
Wow.
Subsequently, my wealth and fortune didn't last long from the NFL, and I retired in 1987. By 1990s, I was headed to the penitentiary because I had chosen a lifestyle of crime and to support my drug habit.
Well, so it sounds to me like what you're saying is it not only cost you your money or your wealth, but it cost you your freedom.
Absolutely. And what I've learned since then is, you know, I was, long before I was physically locked up, I was locked up in a drug addiction and very limited in my life and what I was capable of doing and achieving.
Now, did this start while you were still playing, or is this something that kicked in only afterwards?
It started while I was playing, you know, hanging around people that I wanted to be like. You know, I started to experiment with drugs and alcohol at age 22. Things I had avoided all through college. And, it went from experimentation, quickly to abuse and, as it got to abuse, so I started using powder cocaine, and that, after a few years, that wasn't enough, so I wanted something more intense and graduated to crack cocaine. And that was my downfall. Like I said, subsequently, I landed in prison. I spent most of the 90s in prison. I'm a two-strike felon. I was facing three strikes in 1999 on my last arrest. And if it wasn't for people like Coach Walsh, who was a mentor to me and stuck by me through thick and thin, if it wasn't for people like him, I would still be locked up because I was facing 35 to life.
Wow.
My decisions I made.
Wow. So the kids out there that are thinking, you know, I can just smoke a little bit of pot, or I can just do a little bit of coke, and I'm sure everything will be okay. What you're saying is that oftentimes that's certainly not the case.
Right, and you know what I try to teach those kids that come to me and when they disclose that to me, you know, I talk to them about the the process of addiction, and I let them know that it begins with experimentation, and then it moves to the next step, and then finally to the stages of abuse where you start to hide it from people and your family, and you start to deny that you've got a problem. So it's given me, I've been on both sides now. I've been very successful in a professional career with the 49ers. 6 years ago, I was part of their first world championship team. And then, you know, having fallen to the depths of prison, I've been out there in the streets, the youth and the population that, at-risk youth and population that we serve here at the CARE program, a lot of our students are students that are making some unhealthy decisions there. And so my life experiences have enriched me to not only to advise them from personal knowledge, but to, you know, also educate them on how to change.
Well, I got to tell you, I looked up a little bit on the CARE program, and I mean, I think it's great. But explain it now in detail for our listeners a little bit what it's doing, because I know that it's doing more than just, you know, just truancy. It's dealing with a lot of aspects. It involves building self-esteem, which I think is great, and I think you should talk a little bit about that, where building self-esteem helps them to make the healthy decisions that they need to make on their own, not just wait to have an adult tell them.
Absolutely, Alan. And the CARE program is the population we serve, ages 14 through 17, high school ages, and we work with truant youth who haven't been in school as long as 2 years. this program came about through funding from the Department of Children, Youth, and Their Family here in the city, and we collaborated with the San Francisco Unified School District to provide a program that offers a school environment where the students that come into our program, we can work with them, meet them where they are, because if you haven't been in school as long as 2 years, you can imagine the skill sets are all over the map.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes we'll get kids in that are, for example, 16 years old, and they might only read at fourth grade level. And this is part of the reason why they're not going back to school, because they're embarrassed.
Right.
They can't keep up academically. The other side, the other thing that we do when we get the students in here after we do the intake, we do a needs and risk assessment. Needs and risk assessment to find out the social barriers and stressors that have caused a student to become truant. Oftentimes, we think, looking at a student, oh, he's not going to school because he's lazy. Well, when we do the needs and risk assessment, we're able to determine exactly what those stressors are, and we've learned over time that it could be a whole array of things. It could be domestic violence going on in the family. It could be lack of clothing. It could be lack of transportation, drugs and alcohol in the family. So we look at the whole child and what's going on with the whole child. And once we're able to determine what those barriers are and kind of what the problems are, then we go to work to structure the supports. And when we structure the supports, that's the referral process. We refer them to the services that we identify that are going to help them transcend those barriers. Now, I learned several years ago that we can refer people all the time, but a lot of our families don't make it to the referrals, especially when it comes to mental health. And you want to refer an African American family to a mental health facility because, you know, there's domestic violence or they're out of control with their anger or what have you. And once you make that referral, they never get there.
Right.
So what we've designed, the way the CARE program is designed, is beyond the referral, we take it to the next step, which is called a brokerage. we broker them to the services that they need, that we've identified to get the services. We take them literally, Alan, by the hand.
Yeah.
Let's go. And we're very fortunate because the care program is located here at the Bayview Hunters Point YMCA, and right across the hall from us is the Bayview Hunters Point Family Resource Center. And so it's a short walk.
Mm-hmm.
We get a lot of the services that we need from many of our families. The next thing after we've done the assessment and structured the supports and making sure that the families are getting what they need, we do an academic skill set, and that's what we're able to determine if you need it at fourth grade level and you know that you're. Because we understand that our students are often embarrassed because they don't want their peers to know. So we meet them where they are.
Right.
When I say we meet them where they are, if you read at fourth grade level, we let them know. Once we identify that, you know what, it's okay. We'll meet you there, and we're going to work together to nurture you and bring you up to speed.
Well,
when we transition you back to San Francisco Unified or back to a regular school, now you're going to have what you need to keep up.
Well, I like that. Now, from a funding standpoint, in this day and age right now, I think we all know that programs are getting cut left and right. How are you guys dealing with some of the funding issues? I would imagine that you're probably getting an increasing number of kids that have the need. How are you satisfying that need?
We've been fortunate. You know, the program started off about 18 months ago, and it was a pilot. And we've been very fortunate because there's such a huge need for truancy, huge demand to curb the truancy issues in our communities here in San Francisco. And so we have not been affected by funding yet.
Well, that's
and we've been very. I'm very resourceful, and I'm also a good beggar when it comes to raising funds. Department of Children, Youth, and Family support our program, and being a retired 49er, and my office window, I actually look at Candlestick Park from my office, from my personal office, and so Dr. York is very very supportive of what we're doing here, and so financially we have support right now.
Well, I think that's phenomenal, and I'm really glad that you guys have approached it from the standpoint of the truancy, because I have felt for years that is where that's the starting point of the problem, and so many things then take off from that. Like you said, the further behind they get, the less apt they are to get back into school. You know, if they're not in school, and if their parents are working, then their influences are coming from other people who are on the street or not in school, and it's probably not going to be positive.
Right.
So,
you know, the other thing, Alan, I would love to share, and you mentioned it earlier, is about our the CARE program is an acronym for Center for Academic Reentry and Empowerment. The empowerment piece is huge. In the morning when our students come in, okay, we teach English. That's our core subject here at CARE. We believe that if we can teach you to read it and comprehend it, you can learn any subject. And so in the morning you come in, we come in by 9. From 9 until 11:30 they do English. And then we break for lunch, and we don't have regular school district lunch. We've had support programs from community restaurants here in the community, and they provide us with food, and it's kind of like a kudo, you know, for coming to school. It's an incentive because you get a good lunch. And then after lunch, then we have the empowerment piece. That's the life skills. And life skills, there's what we get to do to address the self-esteem, the way our program is designed, right now we're working on emotional intelligence.
Okay.
Being able to understand your feelings and knowing how to manage your feelings and knowing how to walk into a crowd and an environment and get a thermometer for that environment and knowing what to expect from that environment and how to engage that environment. And going back to self-esteem. Self-esteem is the core skill that helps us to be able the spur of the moment,
mm-hmm.
when peer pressure is kicking in, and one of the kids is not grounded and is astray. I say, hey man, come on, let's go kick it on the block today. Don't go to school. The bottom line is self-esteem is what gives you the ability to look at that student or your friend. You're supposedly free.
Yeah.
You could look them in the eye and say, you know what? I'm going to school today. I have some goals.
Right.
And I have some things I need to do. So we work, self-esteem is huge with us. It helps to address the peer pressure issues, and peer pressure is so huge. It starts in middle school and it just gets bigger as they go up the ladder to high school.
Right. Well, it sounds like what you're saying is that you're making it cool to show that you have the self-esteem to say, you know what, it's cool to go to school. It's cool to get an education. It's cool to, to show that I can, make decisions on my own and not be a follower to that particular type of peer pressure.
Right. Exactly. Not be a follower to that type of peer pressure, And, with the emotional intelligence, being able to look at, the decisions you make and be able to say, okay, if I make this decision, where am I going to end up? The empowerment piece is huge, and it's not really, it's not taught in most schools, but, the empowerment piece, Alan, is a piece that gives our students the ability to stay in school once we transition them back to Self-Sustained Unified. And by the way, that is our objective. Because our objective is to transition them back to San Francisco Unified School District and or a GED track.
Okay.
When I say a GED track, oftentimes we get in students that haven't been in school for maybe a year or two. And when they get in, when they come in the door, they need 230 credits to graduate San Francisco Unified. And they come in the door and they've only got 60 credits. They only got 20 credits.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the reality is this student is not going to graduate by the time they're 18, and sending them back to San Francisco Unified would only be a setup for failure.
Right.
So we look at a GED track. How can we get the student equivalent to a high school diploma and send them on their journey to a vocational trade or college?
Right.
We're huge here at the CARE program on setting goals with our kids. At the end of the needs and risk assessment, that's the final part, is we ask them about their goals, and you often find out that many kids have no goals, Alan.
Mm-hmm.
And when they have no goals, we often have to go back to, well, what did you dream about when you were young, when you were 12 years old or 13 years old? And what used to dream about being?
Mm-hmm.
And then I have to show them how dreams can become reality.
Absolutely.
You actually attach a short-term goals to those dreams. They can become reality. Oftentimes I've had kids walk in my door. They're now coming to school. They haven't been to school for a year or so, and they want to be doctors.
That's right. Yeah.
It can happen.
Yeah.
But, if it's, let's look at how we can do it step by step, day by day, to get there, you know. And I describe a short-term goal to them and say, imagine yourself on this side of the San Francisco side of the Bay Bridge, and you're trying to get over to Oakland. Your short-term goal is getting across that bridge.
Right.
And once you get across that bridge, you get to Oakland, now you reevaluate and you set some more short-term goals.
Wow. Sounds like it sounds like somebody's pounding on the wall behind you to get to you.
Yeah, you know, the YMCA is under construction here, and we're being our building is
Let me touch on a couple of things, because I know that our time is short. One of the things is I noticed, I mean, you have a really good strategic outreach and education plan. Is that something that is being offered to other districts? Because it's one of the things that, I mean, it's something that should be out there through all the districts. So is it being offered, or are they at a wait and see standpoint to see how you do? You know, I know that this show goes out to a lot of special ed district coordinators and such. So if they're out there and they're listening to this, how can they get this information and see about setting it up for their district?
Well, the CARE program, like I said, it started off as a pilot program, and as we speak there, the CARE program number two is under construction, if you want to call it that, and they're hoping to launch that program in January. And that program is going to be launched in the Western Addition part of San Francisco, another highly populated truant area here in San Francisco. The reason why I started it in the Bayview Hunters Point was the first community identified to get a truancy program, because we have the highest concentration of truants per capita here in the Bayview.
Well,
the next place is going to be over there in West Addition, and I've been in direct communication with the powers to be to help design that program, and as we learn from our successes and our failures.
Well, before the construction crew knocks down the wall next to you, one of the things that I always want to hear is, give us a success story. Give us one of your favorite success stories, so that people can now kind of visualize the type of success that young people are seeing from this program.
Well, first of all, in three semesters, we served 87 youth and their families coming through our program. And of those 87 youth, approximately 55 of them have been transitioned back into San Francisco Unified and or a GED track. Now, these are kids that aren't going to school. Like I said before, some of them as long as 2 years. And they've been transitioned back into school. And of those 53 who've been transitioned back into school, now 5 of them have completed high school requirements. They have their GEDs, or the California High School Proficiency, passed the California High School Proficiency exam.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's 5 students now that were otherwise just out there floating and in the way of crime and everything else out there in the streets. And now they've completed their high school requirements, and all of them are going to San Francisco City College.
Well,
that's
huge.
An overview of our success. And you know, I have students that students and families that, I mean, you can imagine, when because I've had families that have come in and they really, really want their children to go to school, but they're doing everything, and then they just can't figure out why. And one of my first students that came in here is a Latino young man, 17 years old. This young man was hooked on ecstasy. And this young man was in the party lifestyle and just, you know, didn't care about anything. But when we set him down and we talked to him and then we pulled his record, his school tune folder, this young man already passed the high school exit exam. But he was deficient and not going to school and deficient credits. So here's a young man when he got here, he started off on fire. Then his addiction stuff started showing up and he come up missing. Here's a young man that I had to go to his house. I can't even tell you how many times I had to go to his house and knock on his door. But then he started to see that somebody actually cared. And he started to see that I wasn't going anywhere, that I probably knew what I was talking about because I'd been on the other side and had been through some of the same things that he was going through. We transitioned that young man after he'd been in our program. We transitioned him after 4 months over to a GED program. That was our first success story. A young man is at City College and now is on his one more semester to his AA degree.
Well, Eason, I got to tell you, I mean, I think you hit it with the key word, and then you obviously named your program appropriately, and that is care. As soon as that person knew that you cared and you weren't just doing a job, I think that's when it kicked in for them. I got to tell you, I really appreciate talking with you. We're running out of time. But again, keep up the good work. Now, if anybody needs to get information in regard to this, what website or phone number should they use?
They can call the care program at 415-822-5300. They can also contact me through email at eramson@ymcasf.org.
That sounds great. Again, thank you so much. Oh, and another little quick question, because I've got a person who worked for us for some time. Actually, you may know Reggie Doss. But one of the things he would do when he was transporting the kids was he would have them try on his Super Bowl ring. So some of these kids, do they have an interest in your Super Bowl ring?
Oh, absolutely. I've had kids that come in that, you know, have an aspiration of being, you know, playing pro football, you know. And, you know, I've had, I sit on the student attendance review board for San Francisco Unified School District, and they saw it here, and there's been times where I took off my ring and I put it on a young man's hand and I let him know that, you know what, you deserve the best that life has to offer.
Yep.
And you deserve to achieve your goals. And I put the ring on him and I said, look, that can be yours.
There you go.
All you have to do is start setting some short-term goals, making them happen.
All right. Eason, I thank you. Everybody out there, think about it. Put on the ring that you want. Whatever it is that's your Super Bowl, put on that ring because you can do it as long as you set your mind to it. Eason, thank you again so much.
You're
all right.
Founded over 25 years ago to meet the needs of families in crisis, West Shields specializes in resolving adolescent issues that negatively impact the family. From preteen to young adult, we are experienced and qualified to help. We offer solutions which include referrals to a network of top professionals internationally that we work very closely with in the fields of educational consulting, psychology, and psychiatry. Our in-home crisis intervention care program helps to stabilize families and bring effective resolution. We are supported by our licensed investigation company that enables us to offer legal and expert services for locating runaway teens and more. Our therapeutic transportation services help to ensure that adolescents in crisis are safely provided transportation to specialized schools and programs with unmatched experience and success. Simply put, West Shield Adolescent Services is the best solution when your family is facing personal crisis. Call 1-800-899-8585 and let us help you.
And we're back. And our next guest is, he is a USA reporter and Grantham Prize winner. He is the co-author of The Smokestack Effect, which has to do with toxic air and America's schools. Blake Morrison, welcome to the show.
Thanks a lot for having me.
Hey, it is great to have you. I got to tell you, for those that have heard the show, they know that I'm also an investigator. And years ago, I did an investigation in a particular community, and I was appalled to find out the amount of toxins that were in a particular community. It was traced back to higher birth defects. I mean, just a lot of different things. So I was really, as soon as I found out what it was that you were doing, I couldn't wait to get you on. So tell us a little bit about why you embarked on this idea to look at industrial pollution and how it impacted upon, you know, how it's impacting the air outside our schools.
Sure. One of the things that we wanted to take a look at was the effects of industrial pollution on children, in part because kids are much more vulnerable to the effects of toxic chemicals than our adults. Their bodies process things differently, and because they're young, they breathe more air in proportion to their weight than adults do. It means that the dosage that they're taking in of these chemicals is maybe about 10 times what it does to us. And so we thought, well, where do kids go? And the obvious answer is school. So we took a look at the best EPA data that were available, and the EPA created a model that is called Risk Screening Environmental Indicators. It takes information that's part of the public right to know laws called the Toxic Release Inventory, and it tries to give it meaning, much like a meteorologist predicts the weather. And so what happened is we took a look at where the emissions go from the smokestack of these facilities, and then we overlaid the locations of about 128,000 schools in the country. The goal was for us to see what kind of things were in the air outside these schools. We took it a step further. Then we teamed with Johns Hopkins University, and we went out and did monitoring ourselves at about 100 schools around the country. And we found what the model predicted, which is that in a lot of those schools, the amount of chemicals in the air, the toxic chemicals, are higher than what the government considers safe.
Well, now, what was the response of the EPA when you told them that you essentially went out and did it yourself?
Well, the first response the EPA gave us was that this was not their responsibility. We talked to the head of the Office of Children's Health Protection, and as far as we could tell, if there was anyone's responsibility at EPA, it should have been hers. And her response to us when we told them what we had done is that it wasn't her responsibility, that it would have been handled by a different office. Thankfully, when the new administration took over, they saw it differently, and through the aggressive actions of Barbara Boxer, the senator from California, she pressed the new EPA administrator, Lisa Jackson, to commit to doing a monitoring program similar to what we did, except certainly much better. Better in so much as these are the people who know what they're doing, they should be doing it. What we were able to do is provide an illustrative look, a demonstration of what was out there, but really this is work better left up to people who do this for a living. And so what they've done is they've now started looking at 63 schools around the country, and they've been releasing preliminary results the last few months, and what they found really reinforces a lot of our findings. Most recently, they found a couple of schools where there were high levels of manganese outside. Now, manganese is a chemical that's often used by metalworking facilities and that is emitted by them. And the consequence of breathing this at high levels for long periods of time are basically developmental-type disabilities, impaired movement and so on. In the worst cases, a disease called manganism that affects one's ability to essentially process information and to move. In some ways, it's a neurotoxin similar to lead. And so we feel like as part of what the EPA is trying to do, hopefully there are going to be communities out there where this will make a big difference.
Now, are there some particular areas that we need to be worried about? I mean, for many of us obviously have kids in these schools. Is there particular geographical areas where it's considerably higher, and this has been now proven out by the additional problems that the kids are having?
Well, one of the things that we would recommend people do, parents do, is go to a website that we've set up called smokestack.usatoday.com, smokestack.usatoday.com. And if you go to that website, you'll be able to type in the name of any school in the country, literally any school in the country. What it will tell you is what the best government data suggests is likely in the air outside. Now, keep in mind, this is based on a model, and that model is used by the government to essentially track the path of industrial pollution. What it will tell you, if you go to that, is what kind of chemicals are likely in the air outside, at what levels they're at, so that you can make some idea of how dangerous things might be. And if you put your cursor on the chemical itself, you'll get a description of the kinds of health effects those chemicals have on the human body. Now, keep in mind, most of the studies that have been done have largely been done on adults. And so when you take a look at the effects that those chemicals have, you can almost magnify that, some people say, by 10 degrees. And in that case, you'll see far worse things that could happen to your children.
Wow. Now, are they able to go back? In other words, can they go back? And for instance, if there are particular schools where there's been a higher rate of certain types of diseases or a lower rate of growth, can they go back and tie this into some of the schools that happen to be placed very close to some of these industrial areas that are putting out huge amounts of toxins?
Well, they may very well be able to. Let me tell you what we found. There were a couple of schools that we looked at pretty closely as far as using them as baselines for knowing what was going on. One was in Addison, Ohio, and across the street from that elementary school is a plastics plant that for years was emitting a couple of chemicals that are pretty bad, acrylonitrile and butadiene. Now, when the Ohio EPA went in 2005 to actually do monitoring and measurements after complaints from neighbors, they found that those levels were 50 times higher than what the state considered acceptable. Okay? So the risks that they were posing to the people who lived nearby were substantial. When they went back and took a look at cancers and other incidents of disease in that area, they found much higher levels, and they said that they couldn't rule out that it was coming from that particular facility, but that was the reason. Now, part of the problem is this, that because there's a latency involved in cancer, and because it doesn't show up for maybe 20 or 30 years sometimes after exposures, it's really hard to know for certain what the cause is. It's really hard to know for certain if you can track it back. But there was another set of schools in Texas that were also located near some rubber plants that were emitting butadiene. And if you go back and listen to the students talk about what they were encountering when they'd walked to school, they would talk about sweet-smelling clouds of butadiene hovering over the roads. Now, they didn't know what it was, but certainly years later when they contracted cancer, they did. And those are students who have since sued those facilities and have settled with those facilities. What we wanted to really focus on, though, was exposure, because exposure is supposed to be a barometer for disease, and it gets very difficult to track cancers or other diseases years later. But one thing is clear, that if you are being exposed at high levels to dangerous chemicals, you are increasing your risk of getting something bad. It's much like smoking.
Sure.
We can't necessarily prove that everybody who smokes is going to get cancer, but we can say definitively that if you do smoke, you increase your risks.
Right, and as you said, in that one area, that if there's 50 times the amount of a particular toxin in the air, and you have a whatever the percentage was of an increase in cancer, I mean, it doesn't take a rocket scientist, I think, to say that there's some sort of a contributing factor.
Yeah, absolutely, and that's a lot of what we're hearing from people. I mean, the key here, remember, is that these are children. They're not people who are making choices about where to live. The other thing that we found that was very interesting is that if you took a look at the model and you compared the square a kilometer where the school is located against the typical air in the school district, that is, the places where the kids are living, you find that some places there's a vast difference. In other words, kids are coming from areas where the air outside their house is better than it is in the air, it is around their schools. There's one school in particular in Louisiana, six blocks from the ExxonMobil refinery, the nation's second largest refinery. There's a situation where the kids in that neighborhood are coming to a square kilometer that modeled out to be 72 times more toxic in terms of air quality than the rest of the district itself. And that says to us,
wow,
we have to be exceedingly careful where we're putting these schools relative to where we're locating these facilities.
Well, and I think even taking it further, and I don't know if your study has touched on this, but, you know, if that refinery or whatever has been there for, you know, for 50 years or something, I mean, that would mean that, I mean, it's in the plants, which means it's in the water, which, you know, or which means it's in the soil, which means it's in the water. So I think that, I mean, from that standpoint, you not only have them breathing it, but these could be kids that have literally had that in their system through their food, their water, and their air. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. And one of the things that we wrote about this last week was the issue with manganese. There are these two schools the EPA just monitored at where the levels for long-term exposure to manganese, if the samples prove out, are literally twice what the government considers safe for long-term exposure. One of the issues there is that that manganese often settles in the soil. That means that when you have little kids out there playing in dirt, there are a number of different ways that they can be exposed to that, and that's particularly dangerous. That's the sort of stunning thing about this, is that sometimes it's just so insidious you have absolutely no idea how many different ways you're being exposed to it.
Now, what are some of the signs that parents, that they may see in their child that would make them want to take their child to a doctor to get tested for something like this?
Well, one of the things is trouble learning, trouble understanding, trouble simply developing. If you have any concerns about that, you should definitely see your pediatrician. And if you go to that website that I named, smokestack.usatoday.com, mm-hmm. we have one of the foremost experts on this, a guy named Philip Landrigan from Mount Sinai Medical Center, talking about what parents should do with this information. Part of the problem, of course, is that, you know, as children grow, many of them develop very differently. And so sometimes you just don't even know whether what you're seeing may be indicative of a problem or is simply who your child is. That's part of the reason we put up this interactive database. If you go there and you take a look at your neighborhood and you take a look at the kinds of chemicals that are in the air outside and you take a look at the the impact that these chemicals are having, that should equip you to make some smarter decisions both about what you're seeing and what you might be able to do about it.
Well, and it also sounds like, as I know that, I mean, as a parent, I checked the different school districts to see how the entire district was testing. And, you know, and there's a pretty wide gap between different public school districts and how they're testing as a district. And I never thought of it this way. I mean, I thought about the fact that, okay, well, I want to be in this district because, you know, they must have better teachers, you know. But, I mean, now, I mean, listening to this, I mean, some of these districts, they could have the best teachers in the world, and it may be that group of kids over a period of time are just testing lower. That's possible.
Well, that may be. I mean, that may be. I have a friend who's working out in San Francisco right now, she is around the Berkeley area, and there is an issue there where you have a number of parents who are concerned because of some of the things that they think are in the air out there. They are trying to ask the sorts of questions of their community that they ought to be, the kinds of questions of their leaders that they ought to be, which is, what do you know about this? What could be in the air? What can we do about it? Part of the issue there is that you have situations where you might have agencies that are literally giving permits to the companies to emit the kinds of chemicals that they're emitting. But those permits themselves don't necessarily mean that that's what's going into the air. We saw in this Ohio school, for instance, where it was 50 times what was considered acceptable, that the company was actually violating some aspects of its permit because some of the machinery was broken. And so you have to be careful as a parent to make sure that you press your leaders appropriately and you ask them questions like, okay, if you know that this is what they're permitted to do, tell me for sure what they are doing. And the only way to do that is to go out and actually do monitoring.
Well, and that's a great point. Now, is there anything in the works? I mean, obviously with cars, because it's something that, you know, that we all see, and it's been a big issue, you know, with the EPA. So there's different types of mufflers. There's, you know, the different types of fuels that they're trying to do. I mean, essentially they're trying to make changes in it, making cars operate cleaner. Are they doing the same things with the big corporations or the big industrial smokestacks?
Well, I guess that depends on your perspective. I mean, one of the issues that I've raised as I've spoken about this to various folks around the country is we have all of these special provisions for schools and school zones. For instance, we have special speed limits. We have laws that prohibit schools. We have drug-free zones near schools. But one of the things that we seem not to take into consideration is, what about companies that are located near schools and what they're putting into the air? We know that these toxic chemicals disproportionately affect children. We know that the effects can be long-lasting and irreversible. Yet, for whatever reason, we just sort of choose to give a blind eye to them. And I'm not exactly sure why. We hear a lot of people talking about how hard it would be to close a school and to move a school. But again, I wonder why the onus is on the school itself. Why instead could the onus be back on the corporation that is located near those kids? Why shouldn't we be looking more closely at what they're putting out into the air as opposed to putting all the responsibility on the school?
Well, yeah, and make it from the standpoint of, you know, there is an option. I mean, the option is that you either don't put these toxins in the air or you move to a different location where there's not a school within a certain, you know, whatever the distance is that the EPA determines is healthy. And I don't know what that is, but I'm sure somebody does.
Well, I mean, that's part of the issue, is that for some of these chemicals, there is no clarity on what is healthy, in part because there are thousands of them that we don't know very much about. And every year there may be a new chemical introduced, and or a chemical that essentially is a combined chemical. In other words, a company may be emitting two or three different chemicals, and the combination of them has some kind of synergistic effect that's bad on kids. The other thing that people need to keep in mind is, some schools are literally located in a bullseye. That is, there might be two or three companies around them, all of whom are technically meeting their legal limits for what they're releasing into the air, but cumulatively are releasing such high levels of these chemicals that the kids themselves are put in peril. Those are situations that simply aren't regulated.
Oh, I see. So see if I'm understanding that. But, I mean, I think what you're saying is that if you have an oil refinery and a plastics factory and a desalinization plant all putting off, you know, a particular thing, the combination of individually they might not necessarily be in any violation, but the combination of the three may be putting out something more toxic than we recognize.
Absolutely. Okay. I mean, one of the readers who read our project used the term humongous to describe the sort of the effect of this, and I thought it was interesting because what you're doing is you're taking a look at, you know, five different companies. There's one school, for instance, in East Chicago, Indiana, that just seems sort of at the epicenter of every chemical you can imagine. And one of the chemicals that's outside that's sort of being caused by a variety of factors, including automotive exhaust, is this chemical called acrolein. Now, the EPA found this at 15 schools that it monitored in response to the story that we did. And acrolein happened to be used in World War I as a chemical weapon. That's how toxic it can be. Now, it's in lesser levels around these schools, but at one school, the worst school that it found in Spain Elementary in Detroit, for instance, it was 300 times higher than what the government considers safe for long-term exposure.
Wow.
What was stunning to me is when I called the principal to tell him that, he'd been there for 13 years and this was the first he had ever heard of that chemical and had ever heard that it was in that high levels. Had the EPA not been out there in response to our story to actually do the monitoring, he would never know. But he did tell me this, that for years he has sent his school children across the street to the Children's Hospital of Michigan when they had asthma attacks. And, thankfully a hospital is across the street, but that's not true everywhere.
Yeah, well, but still, like you said, I mean, that was 13 years that he'd been there and never heard anything, and if this didn't occur, they probably still wouldn't. You know, I got to tell you, Blake, I really wish that we had more time. This is a great subject. Again, if you can give that website again for everybody.
Absolutely. Smokestack.usatoday.com. Smokestack.usatoday.com.
All right. Again, thank you so much for coming on. And everybody, be safe. Thank you.
Take care.
Listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza. Only on LA Talk Radio.